Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from July 4, 2017. This talk and Sangha discussion is on the Kamsuka Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha uses the metaphor of a swift pair of messengers to teach the importance of right meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is on the Kamsuka Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha uses a metaphor of a swift pair of messengers to emphasize the importance of right meditation. For the 45 years of his teaching career, the Buddha taught only one meditation technique with one purpose. He taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation to quiet the mind and develop concentration. From a well-concentrated mind, refined mindfulness can hold in mind the framework of the entire Eightfold Path. From refined mindfulness, useful insight of the three marks of existence can develop. Keep in mind that when the Buddha taught the Dhamma, there were no divergent schools of Buddhism, only his direct teachings. The two combined aspects of quieting the mind and gaining insight into the three marks of existence, true insight, are taught as the meditation method used as the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, known as right or skillful meditation. It was quite a difficult realization for me to come to, that meditation wasn't a practice for escape. It wasn't a practice to have mystical experiences. It wasn't a practice for learning how to levitate. That might sound silly, but some meditation methods are taught that way. But when I finally realized that meditation was for developing concentration, ultimately it was a relief, because that made sense to me. That could fit into an idea of what I hoped to achieve, which was, I didn't even realize at the time, but it was a calm and peaceful mind. So concentration, once I realized that that was the purpose, it made sense. But it took me a while to let go of other notions and not be disappointed even in meditation. When I had a useful meditation session, there was still this lingering, you know, I didn't travel the galaxy, I didn't have some great breakthrough in understanding, but I did develop concentration. As can be seen in the following story, the Buddha taught that shamatha and vipassana, tranquility and insight, are both necessary components of an effective meditation practice, with an emphasis given to shamatha, quieting the mind, for insight to be meaningful. One of the reasons why I wrote this is we all know the vipassana movement, the insight movement. It's one of the major modern schools of Buddhism, believed to be part of the Theravadan school, and it's loosely associated. And again, I'm not putting down vipassana, but there, and I've done quite a few vipassana retreats. Their focus is more on an analytical type of insight. If you've ever been on one of their retreats, they use quieting the mind as a beginning phase. Usually, you'll do that for 2 or 3 days. And then you'll discard that, and the rest of the time your meditation is a very analytical form of meditation. I don't want to go any further than that. But it diminishes the use of quieting the mind in favor of an analytical type of insight. It was founded in the late 1800s, early 1900s by a gentleman, Burma. I can't think of his name right now. And his purpose was to create a hybridized type of meditation that would be more acceptable to people that weren't really interested in developing a full Buddhist practice. His interest was to introduce a meditation practice that business people would be able to use, and that's where the whole thing started.
Theravada means teaching as the Buddha taught.
Theravada means the teachings of the elders, and so the inference is that it is rooted in what the Buddha taught. And I will say that it's the most authentic of the developed schools, but they take a good deal of license with what the Buddha taught. Most of the underlying text for the teachings of the elders is the third book of the Pali Canon called the Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma didn't come in to be a part of the Pali Canon until at least the third Buddhist council, about 300 or 400 years after the Buddha's passing. And it was introduced to justify some of the new practices that people wanted to incorporate as part. And I'm giving a very brief description of how the Abhidhamma came into being. It's also, the Abhidhamma modifies some of the key teachings of the Buddha, such as dependent origination, and presents that more as a creation myth. And it gets very intricate in how it presents dependent origination or dependent co-arising to allow for what would follow afterwards. Excuse me. Dependent origination, you both know, is a simple and direct teaching of how from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, suffering arises. It leads directly to Four Noble Truths. The Abhidhamma gets into this deep and analytical, multi-layered and multi-cosmic view of creation, and it has very little bearing on what the Buddha taught. Again, and that it was a teaching that was developed later. Not, again, not putting down any school, and certainly not Theravadan, but most of modern Theravadan Buddhism has its roots in the Abhidhamma rather than only in the Sutta Pitaka, the preserved teachings of the Buddha. As can be seen in the following story, the Buddha taught that Shamatha Vipassana, tranquility and insight, are both necessary components of an effective meditation, a meditation practice with an emphasis given to Shamatha, quieting the mind, for insight to be meaningful. I know I've read that twice, I just want to put it in context. Shamatha is often spoken of as developing samadhi, or a well-concentrated mind state. Shamatha also refers to in terms of developing jhana, or a state of deep absorption. So four levels of jhana are often mentioned, and those are simply deeper levels of concentration or non-distraction. The Buddha consistently taught shamatha vipassana meditation with the emphasis on shamatha, on quieting the mind. This should not be misunderstood to infer that shamatha is more important or singularly more effective as a separate method of meditation, only that a quiet, tranquil mind is necessary for true insight to arise. That's in reference to meditation practice that focus only on the breath and don't incorporate the rest of the Eightfold Path and use just meditation and teach meditation in a way that if you meditate long enough with enough strong intention that eventually Buddha nature or Buddhahood will arise from within. And again, may or may not be true. I practiced that school for quite a few years, and it's not something that the Buddha taught. Without insight, there can be no understanding of the causes of discriminating and discursive views and no clear and direct path towards understanding and release from confused and deluded views. It cannot be found that the Buddha taught only shamatha or that shamatha can be discarded at some point with only the intention of gaining insight without first quieting the mind and developing the entire Eightfold Path. The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as a framework for seeing insight into the three marks of existence, with the understanding that we are coming from a place of ignorance, from a place of deluded mind. We need a framework in order to see things clearly. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Ultimately, what is recognized is that all thought is impermanent and fleeting, and the objects of all thought are impermanent and fleeting. This leads to recognition and abandonment of conditioned thinking, allowing an unfettered mind to arise. I'm going to skip a little bit and just get right to the sutta because I talk about what the introduction a lot. Two monks of the Buddhist Sangha were talking. One asked the other, to what extent is one's vision said to be well purified? The other monk answered, when one knows as it actually is the origination and the passing away of the sixth sense base, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. Dissatisfied with this answer, he asked another monk the same question. That monk replies, when one knows as it actually is the origination and the passing away of the five clinging aggregates, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. So you'll recognize these are all important concepts of the Buddha's understanding, but understanding one of them is not enough to develop the entire Buddha's teaching. Still dissatisfied, he asks another monk the same question. Well, when one knows as it actually is the origination and the passing away of the four great elements of earth, fire, wind, and water, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. Still dissatisfied, he asks another monk the same question. Well, when one knows as it actually is that all conditioned things are subject to cessation, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. Still dissatisfied, he seeks the Buddha. He tells him of the answers to his questions. The Buddha replies, "Friend, it is as if a man had never seen a certain tree that changes appearance often, a difficult to describe tree, a riddle tree." That's what the Kamsuka Sutta means, the riddle tree sutta. "He would ask someone to describe a riddle tree. They say that the tree is black as a burnt stump. This is how the tree looked at the time. Dissatisfied with his answers, they ask another to describe a riddle tree. They tell him that this tree has no bark and its pods explode. This is how the tree looked at the time. Dissatisfied with this answer, they ask another to describe a riddle tree. They tell him that this tree has thick foliage with dense shade. This is how the tree looked at the time. In the same way, what these people of integrity were focused on when their vision became well purified is the way that they answered. Suppose, friend, that there were a royal frontier fortress with strong walls and ramparts and 6 gates. In it, there would be a wise, experienced, intelligent gatekeeper to keep out those he didn't know and to let in those he did. A swift pair of messengers coming from the east would say to the gatekeeper, 'Where, my good man, is the commander of this fortress?' He would say, 'There he is, sir, sitting in the central square.' The swift pair of messengers, delivering their accurate report to the commander of the fortress, would then go back by the route by which they had come. Then a swift pair of messengers coming from the west and the north and the south would say to the gatekeeper, 'Where, my good man, is the commander of this fortress?' He would say, 'There he is, sirs, sitting in the central square.' The swift pair of messengers delivering their accurate report to the commander of the fortress would then go back by the route by which they had come." The Buddha then says, "I have given you this simile, friend, to convey a message. The message is this. The fortress stands for this body, composed of 4 elements, born of mother and father, nourished with rice and barley gruel, subject to constant rubbing and abrasion, to breaking and falling apart. The 6 gates stand for the 6 internal sense media, the 6 sense base. The gatekeeper stands for mindfulness. The swift pair of messengers stands for tranquility and insight. The commander of the fortress stands for consciousness. The central square stands for the 4 great elements, the earth property, the liquid property, the fire property, and the wind property. The accurate report stands for unbinding or gaining nibbana. The route by which they had come stands by the noble eightfold path: right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation." That's the end of that sutta. My commentary: as can be seen, the swift pair of messengers of tranquility and insight combined are very effective in gaining entry through the fortress of combined thinking and providing the skillful means, when combined with the moral and ethical practice of the Eightfold Path, of recognizing and abandoning confused and deluded thinking. The Buddha offered no other instructions for gaining insight and understanding to the problem of craving, aversion, and delusion but the Eightfold Path, including right meditation. Engaging in the teachings of the Buddha is known as engaging in the great matter of understanding confusion and delusion and the underlying unsatisfactory life experience. That's about 2/3 of the way through the article. The point of the whole article, that rather long simile, is that the necessity of developing deep concentration to support the refined mindfulness that leads to useful insight into the 3 marks of existence. And once that understanding is developed, the understanding of the interplay between impermanence, the not-self characteristics, anatta, and resulting dukkha, it's only at that point that we can start unraveling the clinging that we've developed from ignorant views. Is that clear?
It's becoming more and more clear.
So that meditation method, combined, the two messengers of quieting the mind and insight, is primarily necessary to support the rest of the Eightfold Path. And the reason why there's an emphasis on this in the sutta, and why I emphasize it often, is that it's very easy to substitute some other meditation practice. There's a lot of different things out there called mindfulness, different meditation practices. Some of them are useful in certain circumstances. None of them should be a substitute for the meditation method we use during Dhamma practice. And what I'm pointing to there is if you want to use other meditation practices or use a quiet mind to spend some time contemplating a concept, that's wonderful. But do that outside of your regular meditation practice. It was remarkable for me when I finally came to that understanding through reading the suttas that the Buddha never taught anything else other than Samatha Vipassana meditation. And he didn't even qualify other meditation methods like I just did. Even when the question was brought up, what about this, what about that, he simply said, I teach Samatha Vipassana meditation and nothing else. He didn't get into other things. You remember the story of the Buddha's quest for awakening while he was seeking understanding, and he studied with two of the most well-respected spiritual teachers of his time, Alarakalama and Udekaramaputta. They both taught what were considered very highly advanced meditation techniques. Both of them are still used today, and he rejected both of them. And both of them were similar, and one was Alarakalama's meditation method was focused on developing this kind of imaginary mind state of dwelling in nothingness. And Udekaramaputta's was to develop this mind state of neither perception nor non-perception, which is really a mind state of deep ambivalence. And again, why anybody would really want to develop that when you think about it. But again, it's still widely taught today in a few of the major Buddhist schools. So again, the emphasis here is the swift pair of messengers of insight and tranquility. Any questions?
When did he teach this? Like, how far into his teachings?
I can only speculate because
do you think it arose from question?
Oh, of course. Almost everything the Buddha taught was taught situationally, in response to either kind of what he's noticed that was occurring within the Sangha, what different monks and nuns might have been talking about or even arguing about, or also what was occurring societal or politically, you know, what was going on in the world around him, and he would address that. And some of these were more direct questions. You know, this one, it seems to be that he heard a couple of monks overhearing something, and then one came to him and said, you know, what's up with this? It's probably somewhat deep into his teaching career, and by that I mean maybe at least 5 or 10 years, simply because there were other people that had awakened, but their perspective was awakened in a certain way. And that doesn't mean as soon as people started listening to the Buddha, a lot of them awakened. By his third, remember on retreat, by his third sutta, the Fire Discourse, it said that 1,000 folks had awakened at that point. So, it could have been earlier. My sense is that it was 5 or 10 years into his career. There's nothing in the Sutta Pitaka that has a date attached to it. Sometimes you can develop a broad understanding of who's referenced. Even when Ananda is referring to a sutta, it usually implies that that's at least 25 years into the Buddha's teaching. Even though Ananda was around, he wasn't the Buddha's second. He didn't spend every minute with the Buddha until after about 25 years into the Buddha's career. But it's a good question. How's your practice going?
It's going very well. These past 2 weekends, I've been weighing at the beach, reconnecting with high school friends, and people started asking me about my meditation practice.
Really?
Yeah, I talked the Eightfold Path. I talked about my meditation practice, and yeah, it was kind of funny because I feel like, you know, such a freshman in my journey, and
some of them thought I was so wise. I said, I'm still learning. I said, I can tell you what I've learned, but I'm still learning. So it was good, you know. It, there were I met, you know, one friend invited me, one high school friend invited me, and all of the other people were people she was associated with through work. So I was meeting all of these people. And just, you know, the age that we are, there were different things that people were dealing with. And so I, you know, I think I was able to be helpful to some of these people, to just reframe the way they were thinking.
Yeah.
It felt good to be able to talk a little bit more coherently.
Yeah.
The Eightfold Path. I think the retreat really helped that
too. Yeah. It really. I wish I could make everyone go on retreat because it's so, it's just so effective in really integrating, yeah. integrating the path, and it's just so meaningful to be able to say what you know, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know it. You know you're. You know an awful lot because you put the right effort in to develop it.
Yeah, I'm still piecing. You know, it's all in layers.
Yeah.
And the more you know, the more you need to know, and the more you find out there is to know. So it's peeling the onion.
Yeah. It's wonderful, though, isn't it? Glad you're here tonight. Liz, good to see you. Thank you. I got an email from Jen. Inquiring about our classes.
Oh,
she said,
good.
Yeah, so I hope
she's
so.
My chiropractor.
Oh, good.
Yeah. She knows the plan. And she knows the plan. So,
good. I hope she joins us.
Yeah. Jennifer Redman.
Oh, I know the name, probably from just hearing.
Maybe I've mentioned
her. Yeah, maybe. I think.
I'm glad she reached out.
Yeah. Thank you.
My practice is going well. Learning new things every day. I feel like my energy is better, my more level-headed energy. I feel like I've softened a bit.
Mm.
No, it's good. I haven't quite learned how to talk about it with other people, but I did talk about it with another. So I often imagine there's just thousands of people sort of lurking out there, people we've referred, you know, and once in a while will come in like a beehive. But now it's all good.
Yeah, thank you.
Good.
It is like that. People here over the years, people come in, some, you know, they just stick their toe in for a little bit, and then they try it out. They might not come back for a while, then they come back.
Mm-hmm.
And some, it's just, it was never meant to be something that would appeal to everyone. And I'm talking
when
now.
When you're ready to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
because I know I experienced lots of different things before I found my way here.
Yeah. Even the Buddha realized, upon his awakening, he was considering. Should I teach this? How do I teach it? Is anybody interested in it? And he had this understanding. It's taught metaphorically that this Brahmin god came down and said to the Buddha that if there is just a few with just a speck of dust in their eyes, you must go out and teach. And of course, that was just something that he realized on his own, I think. And that's how he set out to present it. He never saw himself as a savior of the world. And even that thought would contradict the first noble truth, that as a consequence of living in the world, there's going to be dukkha. There's no salvific way to end that. But on an individual basis, he realized that as individual human beings, we could develop this on our own. He never thought that the whole planet or the whole universe would take to the Dhamma. He just set out to do what he could do. And that's all we can do when we're talking about it or being an exemplar of it. That's it. I did send my book to President Trump, though, thinking.
Yeah. You said that the other day, and I was listening to that talk when I did a 6 mile walk the other day, and I was listening to that class, and people were sort of talking, and then I hear John say, and I sent my book to Donald Trump, and no one in the class picked up on it. I thought, oh my God, I have to. So have you heard anything?
No. You know, you never know. It's worth a try.
It's more than 3 pages, and there aren't any pictures.
Well, maybe Ivanka will get a hold of it first. And,
maybe even just the person opening the mail.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I haven't lost my mind over recent times or even. Going back, I mean, the political crisis now is nothing new. It might be more exaggerated because of the rhetoric, but everything is impermanent. An aspect of dukkha is people in authority always at loggerheads. You know, that's just part of it, and I don't have to get drawn in. I mean, that's one of the things that I feel most fortunate about is I don't have to get drawn into anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I can maintain a mindful awareness without losing my mind over anything. I mean, that's remarkable. Because, I mean, there was a time when I was a much younger man, I took up every cause that came along because the world has to listen to me.
That's a lot of the message that I kind of, in response to what people were saying to me about different situations in their life where people would get them fired up, or you know, a relationship was going a certain direction. And I just, you know, broke it down. Hey, you don't have to own that. You can be calm in your space, and the less you push back on that, the less they have to push against it. And it's just kind of figuring that.
That's exactly right.
A friend of mine said, you know, at the carnival when they have the roller coaster, there's always a bench there. You can sit on the bench. You don't have to get on the roller coaster.
And just watch it. That's great. Mm-hmm. The Buddha talks about, because of ignorance, we join with dukkha. We become one with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all part of it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Taking positions, getting into self-righteousness is all part of joining with dukkha. And awakening, an awakened, fully mature human being, no longer clings to dukkha. They're no longer joined to the issues of the world. It certainly doesn't mean that we're unconcerned, and it certainly doesn't mean that we are removed from it in any meaningful way. The Buddha, upon his awakening, and during the 45 years during the last 45 years of his life, he was deeply involved in the political and social problems of his time. But he always counseled in relation to the Four Noble Truths. And it was always effective, too. And then I always think of King Ashoka, who came to power about 300 years after the Buddha's passing. He was probably one of the most bloodthirsty rulers the world has ever seen, then or now. And he came across the Dhamma. It impacted him in such a powerful way that he awakened, and he never harmed another soul. And he started universal health care back then. Do you hear that? I'm not taking a political stance on that either. But it really is remarkable. The point, bringing it back to individuals, all we can do is awaken ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear me say often, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all other sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. It's the most powerful thing we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions or comments on tonight's class? So we'll continue next week with the second talk on the Eightfold Path, on the virtuous aspects, and continue with that. So let's finish with metta like we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And as you both know, metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path, and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature mind. The Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.